Well, thank you, Steve. Well, at this current time, we observe the news. We can't help, can't get away from it, watching the television. We can see trouble is brewing in the world. Where is the situation currently in the Ukraine heading? It's could go either way. It seems troubling. There is America is backing, encouraging, and supporting. And we then have got the US sending arms to a former Russian communist state. So how does Russia look at it? We can see the tensions in world events, in world situations that we currently go through. And I wonder, what if the reverse was the case, where Russia was sending arms to a seceding American state? We need to see it from all angles. And okay, what's going to happen with communist China? The population there is 1.5 billion, close enough. And there is an ominous silence, and it's almost like a powder keg. It can just explode. But we see it just continuing, and there's an uneasy silence. Let's go to Matthew 24 to begin. Matthew 24. And also, now I don't know if I'm absolutely completely correct in American politics. We see from this side of the world, we see a perceived weakness in the American leadership. We don't see a strong president. So it's concerning. Matthew 24. These are times of potential extreme trial, of potential tribulation, and of war. We don't know. We don't, anything can happen. Matthew 24, and we look at verse 6. Is this or is this not the times that we live in, we have been living in? And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you do not let these things disturb you. For it is necessary that all these things take place. But the end, linked with wars, is not yet. Verse nation, this is verse 7. Firstly, this is what has got to happen. For nation shall rise against nation, countries at war, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines, okay, as a result of war, famines and pestilences and earthquakes in diverse places. Now, all these things are the beginnings of sorrows. This is not a time for spiritual sleep. It is not a time for slumber. Yet nothing happens, and we hear. Now, there are urgent times ahead of us, realize it or not. There are challenges ahead right now. And looking at the personal and individual level, coming down a little to the personal, the individual, we all have faults, all of us. We all have weaknesses. Yet there is encouragement. We need to seek encouragement. There are many examples of encouragement in God's word, and we need it, especially as we go through these times, as we observe. Now, what I'm going to do is focus on the example of a character, one that I've done before, but an individual who likewise had faults and who, well, like we all have faults, and who overcame them, and we need to overcome as well. His name actually translates, or his initial name translated and meant supplanter, one who takes by the heel, a shyster, a backstabber, as it were. More correctly, identified his natural slant of character, his initial slant of character, a devious schemer. Yet, he was called of God. He had an incredible high calling. And, you know, we understand God does call the weak of the world, but not to stay weak. He had a high calling. Now, there was a spiritual gold nugget of character potentially there in his weakness. And there was a big plus in his character. Now, it was, what was it? It was determination that was developed. It was a fervent desire. Why? For an inheritance, for something of incredible value. And this led him to change, just like we need to change, you and I, continually. Now, his inheritance was one that turned out to be an eternal spiritual inheritance. And the promise to us is likewise an eternal spiritual priceless inheritance as well. You and I need to take note. We're going to look at Isaiah 9, and then we're going to go to John 14. Actually, it is imperative that we internalize this fact that we are in a similar position now. Such personal and individual promises have been made, clearly made to us, clearly documented to us. Why? Because we also will inherit. We, it's about an inheritance, also stand to be rewarded with an incredible reward. Just like those documented in Hebrews 11, we have an incredible reward. The reward will be unending. It'll be continuing. Isaiah 9. Let's go to Isaiah 9, verse 6, and then we're going to go to John 14. Isaiah 9, 6, for unto us a child is born, and unto us a son is given. Now, this was not properly understood until Christ was actually impregnated in a physical mother, right? And he had to live a physical life. Continuing on, the quote, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father. When shall his name be called that? At the time when the marriage of the Lamb takes place. Can we visualize? Think about it. Can you visualize this time, this reality? The Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace, verse 7, and of the increase of his government and peace, there shall be no end. That in itself is an incredible thing. Can we think about no end? Everything ends. Everything ends, all our experience. Everything finishes. But this is an incredible, incredible prophecy. Upon the throne of David and over his kingdom to order and to establish it with judgment and with righteousness from henceforth forever. Now, I wonder, I say it again. We read things and we can think about it, and I ask the question, does forever really register with you and with me? Never ending, always growing in splendor, in beauty, in accomplishment, in achievement. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. Now let's have a look at John 14. And I ask, how many times have you read this verse? And we could ask, can I understand forever? Forever. Can we understand that? Unending. Continuing. Never to finish. It's hard. It's a hard concept to, let me put it this way, for corruption to be able to grasp. And that's what we are. We're corruption. To grasp incorruption forever. John 14, verse 2. We read of some promises. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. Again, does this really sink in? What is this promise? What is Christ saying? There are many dwelling places. And if it were otherwise, underlining it, I would have told you. And I'm going to prepare a place for you. That's you and me, potentially. We're not there yet. Prepare a place. Verse 3, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come again and receive you to myself, so that where I am again, you may be also. Just note the word you. It's used 4 times in these 2 verses. Now, can we ask ourselves, really ask, really meditate and really grasp the height, the depth of this promise? This is not story time. It's not story time. It's not ethereal. It is specific. It's not imaginary. But it is ironclad. And it is individual to each and every one who is faithful and has received the promise as on the journey. The promise of the Spirit, it's personal. It's to you and it's to me. A promise of tomorrow, a tomorrow with continuing and unending accomplishment. I'm going to draw this out. Now, a question. How would you feel if suddenly, by some reason, something happened and you were to inherit, or some distant relative died or whatever, and you were to receive 10 townhouses, 10 properties that would be worth millions from a long lost relative that you never knew? Have you ever really had a great day when something good happened for whatever reason? It takes me back to my childhood when we were spiritual. We are spiritual children, right? There is something about the simplicity of childhood, and we again are spiritual children. And I remember as a child, a few occasions when I was given a fabulous little gift. It was only a little gift, but man, that meant so much. I couldn't wait to wake up the next morning to see my gift. In Luke 16:11, Christ refers to the promised inheritance in this way, with these words, who, just cutting in there, who will entrust you the true riches? The true riches. True riches. Not the ones that you leave behind sometime, but true wealth. But I think, how tragic, think about this, how tragic would it be to see the promise in all its beauty, all its joy, and all its splendor, and to realize that you have lost it. Think about it. It's something that we need to weigh up, and we need to move away from. You could have had it. How? Why? Lost in exchange for peanuts, the nothing of today. And verse 16. You and I, we are forewarned, though. There is a doing involved. There is activity involved so that we can inherit. And the activity is now. The responsibility is now. The accomplishment is now. A believing, a way of making sense of every single day. Galatians 5, verse 16. Now this I say, walk by the Spirit and you will not fulfill the lust of the flesh. It's about character. It's about who you and I become. Verse 17. This is the principle. This is the reality. For the flesh lusts against the Spirit. It's our natural state. And the Spirit against the flesh. Now, you can't have both. It's either one or the other. You know, either you're in the flesh, the mind of the flesh, or the mind of the Spirit. And the Spirit against the flesh. And these things are opposed. There's a battle. A daily battle. These things are opposed to each other so that you cannot do those things you wish to do. It's natural. The things that we want to do or we would naturally do are wrong. We have to walk a path of wisdom, of understanding that God has laid before us. Verse 18, but if you are led by the Spirit or plugged into the power source day by day, that is when things really happen. You are not under the works of law. Verse 19, now the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these. Okay, the natural state, whether we realize it or not, that we have to continually struggle against. And, you know, it's, who can say I have no sin? Who can say it? Need to be aware of it. This is the reality day by day by day that we face. Our minds are geared this way and we need to fight. It's a struggle. Now, the works of the flesh are manifest, which are these: adultery, fornication, uncleanliness, licentiousness, and so on. Keep your place here, and we're going to move around a little bit here. And I'm just going to quote a principle in Matthew 5, verse 28. You can just note that down. Matthew 5, 28. But I say to you, everyone who looks, okay, the Spirit, the thinking, and it not only applies to one case, it applies to all cases, all potential. There are the fruits of the flesh. We understand that. We won't go there. But I say to you, everyone who looks upon a woman to lust after her has already committed adultery with her in his heart, or in principle. Any natural desire of the flesh that is contrary to God's instruction. Verse 29, or God's way, God's law. So then, if your right eye shall cause you to offend, now, you know, we're not going to pluck our eyes out, but this is underscoring the importance, the focus that God puts on right thinking. Pluck it out and cast it from you. Pretty heavy emphasis. I wonder, I mean, should we ask, do I take this for granted? How many times have we read this? How serious is it? We're looking at becoming different and growing. For it is better for you that one of your members should perish than your whole body be cast into Gehenna, the lake of fire. Well, this is a principle that applies right through. I mean, it's an example, but it's a principle that applies right through. Single-mindedness is needed. We need to have or develop a guidance system, a laser beam focus, no sidetracks. And you and I know when we're on a sidetrack. And that's what God is saying. No sidetracks. The Apostle Paul stated that an enlisted soldier, right, is there to do the will of the one who enlisted him, who sent him. So, in other words, we're under orders. Bottom line, there is no wriggle room here. And let's look at Matthew 6, verse 24. It's not a matter of choice here. It's a matter of what we've got to do. We cannot serve two masters. Matthew 6 and verse 24. It's also in Luke 6:13, but we'll look at Matthew 6:24. Very clearly outlined for us all. Matthew 6:24. We read, no one, not double-minded. This is a specific and very, very clear. No one is able to serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will hold on to the one and despise the other. It's about what I hold on to. Note, the dominant thought is the one you and I hold on to. Continuing with Galatians 5, we're going to go to verse 22. In Galatians 5, verse 22. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faith, meekness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. Verse 24, but those who are Christ's have crucified the flesh. Well, that's, we got to stop there. Have those that are you of Christ? Am I of Christ? We need to ask the question. Have crucified the flesh? This doesn't sound like a casual matter. What does crucify mean? A lot of pain, killing, slow death. The flesh, the nature, needs to suffer a slow, painful death. But those who are Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and lusts. That's quite gruesome. It means no mercy, no going easy. It means no feeling sorry, just a painful execution. And should I ask, how am I doing with applying that mandate daily? How are you doing? Merciless. When we see, do we bury? Do we attack without mercy? Yeah, I mean, I picture a bloodied, suffering, nailed body in excruciating pain. That's what I picture. You know, do we attack what's wrong? The fruit of the flesh. What intensity do we apply? Seeking continually God's strength. Imagine crucifixion. What an incredible thing! Crucified, fighting for every breath of air, with no mercy. There's no room for movement here. It's absolute. That's the attitude we need to have. No turning back. And again, we can't serve two masters. You know, overcoming is a heavy mandate, right? It's a one-way street, again, with no turning back. Verse 24, but those, again, those who are Christ's have crucified the flesh with its passions and lusts. Now we know through baptism that the promise is there to us, right? But it requires continual striving. Otherwise, we will be overcome. If we live by the Spirit, we should also be walking by the Spirit. Our direction at baptism or on the way to baptism and being baptized in the future, our direction changed just like Jacob's direction changed. For Jacob, it was a determination, a fervent desire for an inheritance that turned out to be eternal. A spiritual inheritance. Let's go to Genesis 32. You and I need to realize this. But fact is, there are some who take God's ironclad promises for granted. Today, we need to consider. If the difficulty before me, if the difficulty before you, if the trial that I am faced with, if the trial that you are faced with of the situation ahead and one that you may well be facing now seems to be without resolution, here's a question. Are you losing ground? Here's a question. Am I losing ground? Or are we standing firm regardless? It may seem to be dire. There are troublesome situations. There are trials that are there to strengthen us. But we don't know where, when, how resolution comes out. You know, it might be one of finances. It might be one of a relationship that it can be a torturous trial, perhaps one of health. Let's go to Genesis 32. Among other things, we need to keep in mind that there are priceless lessons to be learned from observing the life and the character and the growth in character of Jacob. He had mountains to climb, mountains. From the time God began working with him, you know, his character was a trickster, a shyster, and to what he became. How? How did he change? By striving, by believing, by being moved with a fervent desire, moving towards what? A reward. The reward. The reward is what motivated him. The inheritance, the priceless promise. And he valued it. He valued it. Genesis 32. We're going to go to Genesis 32. This desire can be encapsulated by the events of one night. In microcosm, we can see a desire, the events of this one night in his life. It's a summary, a snapshot of the mindset that he had, of determination, one that you and I will do well to emulate. You see, he's dead now, but he's made it. He overcame. He overcame his weaknesses and so on. Never yielding determination is what he had. It is there. The example is there for our instruction. It's there for our inspiration. Yours and mine for every single day. Let's go to Genesis 32, verse 24. Okay, this one event. And Jacob was left alone. And are there times when we are left alone, when we think and feel what is happening, when we don't know which way to necessarily, we know which way to turn, but we don't know what's happening, the strange trial that comes upon us. No one else is there. Okay, and Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled there with him until the breaking of day. They're just words, aren't they? He was left alone, and he wrestled to the break of day. Can you imagine all through the night, not yielding, not giving in, but striving? You know, there's something poetic about this wrestling example here, about striving through the night until the daylight. Verse 25, and when the man saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh. That was enough. Done. It gets worse. And the hollow of Jacob's thigh became out of joint as he again wrestled with him, didn't stop, kept going. It got worse, but Jacob didn't yield. It can get incredibly difficult and hard, whatever trial you may be facing, might have to face, but you never, ever let go. Think about that example. He wrestled through the night. We go through a night of trial, but we need to hang on and never, ever yield, never let go. He never made an excuse. And verse 26, and he said, okay, let's read verse 25 again. And when the man saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched a hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh became out of joint as he wrestled, as he still wrestled with him. Verse 26, and he said, let me go, for the day breaks. And Jacob said, I will not let you go, except you bless me. You know, when there's a trial, there's a difficulty that we go through, do we let go? If we're asking for something, if we're, whatever difficulty we may be facing, do we let go? Or do we hang on and hang on to the promise until we are delivered? read verse 26 again. And he said, let me go, for the day breaks. Okay, don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. And Jacob said, I will not let you go. We do not let go. Not let you go, except you bless me. And practically, as I say, we can ask, you and I can ask, when it's tough, when it hurts to hang on to a promise, when we think it ain't going to happen, do I get discouraged? Do I let go? Or do I hang on regardless? That's the lesson there. Now, keep your place here, and let's go down to Revelation 2. Had a Revelation right the other side, and verse 17. Revelation 2, verse 17. And we read, the one who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To the one who overcomes, like Jacob, there's the example for us. I will give the right to eat of the hidden manna. What's the hidden manna? I mean, God tells us, Christ inspired it. What's the hidden manna? God willing, we'll find out. All of us will find out. And I will give it was always in masculine gender here, but I will give him or her a white stone. This is a new term to us. I mean, we've read it before, we know, a white stone, but obviously it's one of great meaning in the spiritual realm. It's associated with the reward, with overcoming, with growing, with being accepted as an overcomer. And on the stone, a new name, which no one knows except the one who receives it. Personal, individual, unique. Now let's look at, again, back to Genesis 32, verse 27. And he said to him, okay, what's your name? And he said, Jacob. Supplanter, one who takes by the heel. And he said, your name shall no longer be Jacob. You're not a supplanter anymore, but Israel. For you have striven with God and with men and prevailed. A new name. And that brings up something else. We're given a new name as well. In Revelation, interestingly, to those who overcome in this age, there is also a name change and a promise, which is personal, which is unique, which is individual. Let's turn to Luke 14 and go through Luke 14. Christ has given a bottom line here, Luke 14. We all know it, yet some of us, even though we're told, some, even though it's been said and told, we'll miss out. Luke 14, and we'll start at verse 16. But he said to him, a certain man made a great supper and invited many. And he sent his servants at supper time to say to those who had been invited, come, for everything is now ready. The promise, the promises. But everyone with one consent began to excuse himself. The first said to him, I have bought a field today. Mind is on today, not tomorrow. Not the inheritance. I bought a field and I need to go out to see it. I beg you, have me excused. Would you or I beg to be excused from the incredible priceless promises that are laid there before us to encourage, inspire, motivate us. And that's what it's saying. But everyone with one consent, let's see, those who come, okay, verse, I've lost my place there, verse 19. And another said, I have bought five, another excuse. I have bought five pairs of oxen, ten, big deal. He's got 10 oxen, right? That's a big deal, right? And I'm going to try them out. I'm going to prove them, to try them out, see if they'll do what they're supposed to do. It's important. I've made an investment. The focus. I beg you, have me excused. Would that be an excuse? What could be my potential excuse? What could be your potential excuse to lay aside God's promises, which are without measure of value? And another said, I've married a wife. We just got married. Sorry. I've married a wife. And because of this, I am unable to come. Verse 26, if anyone comes to me, you're going to look at where I'm going down to verse 26 and just concluding here. If anyone comes to me, here's the principle, here's the bottom line. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, and in addition, his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And whoever, now think about this one, whoever does not carry his cross, and that doesn't mean just his cross, it means also her cross, right? And come after me, cannot be my disciple. No matter how bad it gets, no matter how difficult it is, you keep moving. You are never, ever to be discouraged. Now, we also are given mountains to climb, even if it may not seem to be so. Let's go to 2 Timothy. Turn to 2 Timothy 3. 2 Timothy 3. Now, the journey that we've been given, the life that we need to lead, is not a walk in the park. 2 Timothy 3. And, well, keep your place there. I'm going to quote Matthew 10:25 first. In Matthew 10:25, we read, if they have called, think about this, the master of the house, Beelzebub, right, prince of demons, right, how much more shall they call those of his household? There is opposition to overcome. 2 Timothy 3, verse 11. You know what sort of persecutions I endured, and the Lord delivered me out of them all. Verse 12. And indeed, now here's the principle. Here's the point. Everyone, there are no exceptions, everyone who desires to live godly in Christ Jesus shall be persecuted. There you go. You are not left out. I'm not left out. We're going to go through difficult times. Why? Because the reward is so great that God has to make sure that we are the genuine article, that we will not turn. You see, the very best that God could create by fiat, who was called the light bringer, bright shining star of the dawn, the very best turned and fought against his maker. He actually thought he had a chance. He wanted a bigger slice. But it was not to be. And so that led, well, basically, God learned. We learned. We made in his image. He learned. There's got to be a better way. And, you know, with us, with our future, unfortunately or fortunately, the way it is produce or perish. There is no other way. There's no other way. So let's see. We're going to James 1. We need to know that the element of determination is needed. What kind of determination do we require? Our path is one that requires continual, as we said, continual effort. There's no slacking off. James 1. There's no proverbial sitting down on the job. It is one of continual improvement, continual growth, continual movement. James 1 and verse 2. Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you are beset by trials, that the testing of your faith produces endurance. We need to learn to stay with it, to be with it, not to forget. But let endurance have its perfect work, so that you may be perfect and complete, not lacking anything. Just a point here about the word endurance. I'd like to just consider a little bit more than just a mention. And we're going to go to Luke 17 after. How is endurance developed physically? Has anyone done distance running, distance running? It's not easy. I mean, you get to 5 kilometers, 10 kilometers, 15 kilometers. You have to pace yourself. You have to focus. You have to put aside pain. You have to keep moving. 20 kilometers. I mean, whatever one could do, whatever you could do, if you are able to run, give it a go. And that is endurance. Physical endurance. Could we say that endurance is exemplified by keeping going, by going a little further than you went before, by pushing the boundaries? Endurance. I've mentioned before about a minimum effort. You have to continually up it. Now, one of the things that we've always thought about, let's get practical. We've always said, and I don't know about you, but it's always been in my mind, that there's a minimum every day to keep spiritually fit, right? It was a half hour Bible study, a half hour meditation on that study, and a half hour's prayer. But it was more like an hour study and a half hour meditation and a half hour's prayer. So there's a minimum effort that we need to apply, a minimum. But do we stick to a minimum? Every now and then we can go a little further and a little further. Keep a diary record. Let's go to Luke 17. And there's a principle there in Luke 17, verse 10. Likewise, you also, when you have done all the things that are commanded you, when you've done it all, say, we are unprofitable servants because we've done that which we were obliged to do. So when you've done it all, not enough. keep going. The emphasis is we've got to overcome. We've got to grow. The beauty of the reward, the value of the reward, it's going to be worth it in the end. Let's go to Matthew 13. Matthew 13 and verse 45. So, with some concluding thoughts, let's look at some of these promises. A pearl of great price is offered. Matthew 13 and verse 45. Again, the kingdom of heaven is compared to a merchant seeking beautiful pearls. Verse 46, who after finding one very precious pearl, went and sold everything that he had and bought it. Sold everything that he had. It's a parable of the kingdom. Nothing, everything comes second best. Everything is second. That is the focus and the priority that you and I need to have. Let's go to Romans 8. Romans 8. Romans 8 gives us a hint in verse 16, a hint of the reward, the treasure that awaits us. It's an encouragement to hang on to the promises. Romans 8 and verse 16. The Spirit itself bears witness conjointly with our own spirit, the spirit that we're given. We don't think like people in the world. We shouldn't go after anyone or any goal that is around us. This is our goal. The Spirit bears witness conjointly with our own spirit, testifying that we are the children of God. Verse 17, now if we are children, we are also heirs of a fortune, unending life, truly heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. Now, can we read that? Can we just read past that? How? Let's look at that. Joint heirs with Christ. If indeed we suffer together with him, doesn't come easy, so that we may be also be glorified together with him. For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared. Okay, you know, we're reading this too fast. This needs to sink in. For I reckon that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory. Brilliance. Different life that shall be revealed in us, for the earnest expectation of the creation itself is waiting the manifestation of the sons of God. Let's go to Revelation 21. And God has inspired an account here, inspired a witness, a documentation, a document of the reward to those who are faithful. Of all the planets, this is the only planet that supports life. But can we grasp the immensity of what is being documented that we're going to read? Is it too much to take in? I mean, hold on. Let me take a breath before I read it. To conclude, let's read the account. Let's go to Revelation 21 and verse 1. Now, it is not a false witness. It's a faithful and true witness. Let's read this slowly. Verse 1, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth were passed away, and there was no more sea. And I, John, saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, where we have a place in there already, coming down from God out of heaven, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. Verse 3, and I heard a great voice from heaven. So a great, you know, that's just a word. Can you imagine a thunderous, deep, empowering words coming out, thundering? I mean, words can't describe it. And I heard a great voice from heaven say, behold, the tabernacle of God, where God lives. The tabernacle of God is with men, and he shall dwell with them. With them. Eyes, flames of fire, burnished bronze, his feet and face shining like the sun in full strength. We got no idea. I mean, we can just only a little glimpse through a glass darkly, as it says. We got no real idea, but we can imagine. And we need to dwell on it and keep it alive. And I heard the great voice from heaven say, behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and he shall dwell with them, and they shall be his people, and God himself shall be with them and be their God. And here's something incredible. And God shall wipe away every tear from their eyes. You're not going to remember. That's an incredible promise. And there shall not be any more death or sorrow or crying, neither shall there be any more pain, because the former things have passed away. They'll pass away. Verse 5, and he who sits upon the throne said, behold, I make all things new. Then he said to me, write this down, for these words are true and faithful. It's underscoring it. It's telling us this is what is going to happen. Think on it. This is the reward. Let's go to Revelation 21. And let's see, I'm in there. Verse 9. And one of the seven angels that had the seven vials full of the seven last plagues came and spoke with me, saying, come here. You know, it can be us as well. He wrote it down, and we can imagine it. It's as if we could have been there with John. We've got imagination. We know this is the truth. Can we think about it? And he carried me away. Let's see. Seven last plague came and spoke with me, saying, come here, and I will show you the bride, the Lamb's wife. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven from God. I got to stop there. Incredible. Having the glory of God. What does God's face look like? The glory of God. And her radiance was like a most precious stone, as crystal clear as jasper stone. And the city also had a great and high wall with 12 gates. And at the gates 12 angels, and inscribed on the gates were the names of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. And on the east were 3 gates, on the north were 3 gates, and on the south were 3 gates, and on the west were 3 gates. Described in detail. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and written on them, we're going to find out all about this, on them were the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. And the one who was speaking with me had a golden measuring rod so that he might measure the city with its gates and its walls, the details. And the city lies foursquare for its length going on. But moving on to verse 18, and the structure of its wall was jasper, and the city was pure gold, opulence, incredible quality, like pure glass. And the foundations of the wall of the city were adorned with every precious stone. The promises that God puts before us. The first foundations was jasper, the second sapphire, the third, and so on. I'm rushing to finish this because I'm on time now. Verse 22, and I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God Almighty and the Lamb are the temple of it, and the city. Can you imagine? No need of sun? There's no need of sun or of moon that they should shine in it, because the glory of God. This is beyond our senses. What an incredible, incredible reward. The glory of God enlightens it, and the light of it is the Lamb. And the nations that are saved shall walk in its light, and the kings of the earth shall bring their glory and honor to it. And its gates shall never be shut, no night. Always opulence, greatness, light, beauty. It's just beyond us. It's just, it can go right over your head. But to meditate and to think about it. And its gates shall never be shut by day, for there shall be no night there. And they shall bring the glory and honor of the nations to it, and nothing that defiles shall ever enter it. Pure, righteous, goodness, beauty, unending. Only those who are written in the Lamb's book of life. And so, in conclusion, sure, we're going through troubled times, but the promises of God are so great, are so incredibly immense, that if we keep our hearts and minds at the right place, nothing can deter us.